When someone comes to my door, I know, because I'm using SimpliSafe. I get an alert straight to my phone and I can see, is this someone I should unlock the door for because I know them, or is it someone I need to tell to get lost? But here's the thing I love most about SimpliSafe. It works when I am not looking at my phone too, because when I'm not keeping an eye out, SimpliSafe is. SimpliSafe is proactive with a double layer of defense that stops crimes before they start. First, AI-powered cameras spot potential threats outside, and then live agents step in, talking to the person through the camera and letting them know they're on video and police will be dispatched if they don't leave. They can even trigger a loud siren or spotlight. That's how you help stop a crime before it starts. And SimpliSafe makes it easy to use. There are no long-term contracts, no hidden fees. You can cancel at any time. It was named Best Home Security Systems by US News & World Report for 5 years running. It offers a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it and see the difference for yourself. This month only, take 50% off any new system. This is one of the best prices you will ever see for SimpliSafe, so don't miss it. Just go to simplisafe.com/problem solvers. Again, that is SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe, simplisafe.com/problem solvers, and lock in your discount. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Are you looking to diversify your business portfolio with high growth opportunity? Discover Mathnasium Learning Centers, the number one math-only education franchise. For more than 20 years, Mathnasium has triumphed in a booming multi-billion dollar tutoring industry with over 1,200 centers worldwide. Ranked on Entrepreneur's Franchise 500 list for 11 consecutive years, Mathnasium is low-cost, recession-resistant, and offers significant growth potential in an expanding market. The demand for math education is skyrocketing, driven by declining math scores and the growing need for STEM skills in today's workforce. What makes Mathnasium a smart investment? Here are four reasons. Number one, affordable entry point and quick build-out time. Number two, high-earning centers with seven-figure annual revenue. Number three, industry-leading 30% plus average profit margins. And number four, trusted brand with high customer satisfaction scores. And here's something extra. They're offering a 25% discount on the franchise fee for former teachers and veterans. Whether you're expanding your franchise portfolio or making your first investment, Mathnasium gives you the systems and support you need to succeed. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com or call 888-763-2604. From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show that solves entrepreneurs' toughest problems. I'm Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and each week I take a problem that you're probably dealing with and get tactical solutions from people who have been there and solved that. So, let's get solving. I have been watching Shark Tank for years and years. I don't even know how long. I watch every episode. And so it was really fun this past summer to interview Robert from Shark Tank, Robert Herjavec. He and I were on stage at an entrepreneur event called Level Up. Super fun. He was interesting and tactical, had a deep and passionate knowledge of sales and operations, but he was also inspirational and motivating. And when our conversation was done, Robert and I walked backstage, and there, waiting for us, was Robert's fellow shark, Damon John, because Damon and I were going to go on stage and talk next. But before we did, Damon grabbed Robert and he said, "Robert, I have never heard you talk like that. You don't talk like that on the show. I had no idea you could talk like that." And it was true, really, as I thought about it, because I also had no idea. On the show, Robert is friendly and warm and insightful, but he's not the tactical wizard that he is in real life. I guess there's just no time for that on the show. There's no space for him to dig into that kind of stuff. And the show, I realized, is only a small glimpse into what the sharks are truly capable of. And come to think of it, most people probably don't know all that much about Robert at all, beyond that he is a famous investor. Because unlike Mark Cuban, who owned the Dallas Mavericks, or Damon John, who founded FUBU, Robert made his fortune doing something that most people consider boring. He built a huge cybersecurity firm. Then he was cast on a show called Dragon's Den, which was the Canadian predecessor to Shark Tank, and he actually nearly quit the show after one season. You'll find out more about that later. But anyway, the point is, people know Robert as a famous investor, but they almost didn't know him at all. And today, most people certainly don't know him as the true business tactician that he is. But if you spend even just a few minutes talking to him, you will. Trust me. Because everything he says is interesting. Like, for example, Robert and I spoke on stage, and then he flew back home to Australia, and we set up a time to talk by Zoom so that I could do a more focused interview with him for the cover of Entrepreneur Magazine. You can find that issue on stands now, by the way. So we hop on Zoom, and somehow within like 2 minutes, we are having a conversation about what value is actually being sold when you sell something. Are you selling the perception of value, or are you selling actual tactical value? And I said, wait a second, hold up. I need to just start recording us. And then, well, then we're in it. Okay, so sorry. So keep going. So tangible value.
So we were, so I was talking to a couple of companies I'm working with, and what we're talking about is the sales process and what is value. And I always believe when customers say to you, I don't get enough value, it's really a bit of a cop-out because value is such a big word. You know, the analogy I use is, it reminded me so much of my high school days when I would ask somebody out and they would say, I'm washing my hair. You know, they weren't really washing their hair. Yeah. It was just an easy way. So when a customer says to you, I don't see enough value, it's masking a deeper problem that you've got to dig into. And so we got into this discussion about tangible value and perceptive value. And tangible value is hard. It's something I can prove to you. Look at this versus that. Perceptive value is the Birkin bag. It's the genius of Hermès creating demand for a perceived handbag where the cost of goods is very basic. So the question is, in the sales process at the beginning, what's more important, perceptive value or tangible value?
It's a fun and interesting question, isn't it? And I came up with an answer on the fly and shared it with Robert, who of course had fascinating things to say. And that was just the start. In this conversation, we dig into sales, we dig into investment. He details what he looks for when he's considering investing in a company and really, frankly, what all the sharks and what all investors are thinking and how to really appeal to them. And let us now undercut that idea, how possibly, perhaps even likely, you shouldn't even try. This is a really fun conversation, and I'm just giving it to you in this kind of raw, unfiltered way. I took this conversation and I wrote a profile of Robert, which you can find in the magazine. Again, just go find the Entrepreneur Magazine edition with Robert on the cover right now at newsstands. But you can also just hear what we talked about and how that conversation flowed and the wonderful, insightful, helpful things that he has to say for any entrepreneur. That is what's coming up today on Problem Solvers right after the break.
We're right here for every catch-up between classes, for every personal best, for every ambition. Here at Canterbury Christchurch University, you're part of a vibrant community that celebrates every small win and every big moment. That's what makes us fifth in the UK for student experience, based on the Sunday Times Good University Guide 2026. Discover the degree for you at canterbury.ac.uk. Canterbury Christchurch University. We're right here with you.
All right, we're back. I am talking today with Robert Herjavec of Shark Tank. And this is the conversation that led to the profile that I wrote of him in the current issue of the magazine. But let's just jump back into it. Right before the break, he had laid out this question of perceived value versus actual value. What is being sold at the very beginning of a sales process? And here was my answer to that question. That's such an interesting thought. I bet you have a really smart answer to it. I've had all of 3 seconds to think about it. So let me just take a stab and then see what you make of my answer. I want to tell you a few things. Number one is, as you were talking about the Birkin bag, I made a connection in my head that I had never done before, which is between perceptive value and network effects, which is to say, you know, like the network effect, right, for a company is, as for those who don't know, is a product becomes more valuable the more people use it. Tinder is not very useful unless lots of people are using Tinder. It doesn't matter how good the UX is. Like, if a lot of people aren't using it, it is useless. So the network effect has to be there. And there's something interesting about the network effect as you apply it to a physical good that has a perceptive value. Like, a Birkin bag is not actually that impressive unless the kind of people that you want to be already have the Birkin bag.
Right.
And so in that way, you almost need to approach it in a completely different kind of sales cycle. To make the Birkin bag valuable is to not sell the Birkin bag originally, but actually just make sure that the right people have it. And then once the right people have it, the perceived value of it goes up, and then you can start to sell it to the right people, but you have to maintain a strict control over who gets it. Because if the wrong people get it, then the perceptive value goes down, because like the value is now tied to perception. Whereas tangible value is provable and has a completely different kind of sales pattern to it. That is about convincing people that it can provide the benefit that they're seeking. And I would imagine that is a easier thing to do upfront, because you can do it for free or at a lower cost and just get it into people's hands. And at that point, it's not about restricting access to it. For tangible value, you don't want the right people to have access to it. You want as many people to have access to it as possible, which means that you don't actually have to be nearly as judicious about who has access to it. So anyway, that is a long way of saying that I think that tangible value is easier to sell than perceptive value. What do you think?
So you said something which I hadn't thought of before, which is the network effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the caveat, and I think this is what makes entrepreneurship so hard. Great entrepreneurs are very comfortable living in gray.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people that have never started a business see it very binary. The answer is either black or white. But I think the answer is, it depends who you're selling to.
Yeah.
If you're trying to create a product, as you said, to network effect, then your tangible value has to be so clear that a consumer can clearly see it. When I log on, I clearly see the difference in your product versus a different product. The challenge, so I would say, if you're selling that kind of a product, an online content product, mm-hmm. a feature set that you're selling online, tangible value has to be very hard, very demonstrable, and very easy to ascertain.
Yeah.
If you're doing enterprise sales or you're trying to call on customers, I think perceptive value is more important because of the noise effect, meaning all your competitors are going to say their value is just as great. You know, it's like I always just say to people is, our competitors are not going to our customers and saying, we suck, go with them.
Yeah.
And so I think in that sales cycle, the first step is cutting through the noise.
Mm.
And for them to see your tangible value, they actually have to want to listen to you. And the first step when you call a customer in that environment is they don't want to listen to you. They want to get off the phone.
Right. Which then brings up the shock the narrative idea, which I have to tell you is the number one thing that came out of those 2 days at Vegas for me. The phrase shock the narrative and the way in which you described it and that story that you told about the young sales guy and how you had him change the way that he was connecting with consumers. Like, I have repeated that at dinners at least 5 times since we talked. It was just a really sharp insight.
I completely forgot I said that. That is so true. It's so true, though. But if you think about today, how much input do we get from all kinds of sources?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like I tell people on Shark Tank, like, we're sitting there, Jason, 12-hour days, pitchers are coming in. We're super excited to be there the first day. By the second day, we're more thinking about lunch than we are about who's coming in next. And then you come in. People always think that we are super excited to see you. The reality, subconsciously, we're really not. Yeah. So it's your responsibility to get me to listen. It's, we had a, I forget whether it was a lady or a man come in a few years ago, and they said to us, "You're not listening to me."
Hmm.
And I think we were probably a little rusty, as Kevin says, and tired. And I said to him, "Hang on a second. It's not my responsibility to listen to you. It's your responsibility to make yourself heard."
What an important distinction.
It's so true, but don't you think most entrepreneurs assume that if you have a better feature set, the world is going to listen to you? Yes. You've got to make yourself be heard.
The president of Reebok once told me this thing that I think about so often, which is that quality doesn't matter. And that's not to say quality doesn't matter in that you can sell a crappy product, but rather that quality by itself doesn't sell itself, because quality has to be assumed. The consumer assumes that everything is good. He used a pair of scissors as an example. He said, "You can't market a pair of scissors as the sharpest scissors. Every pair of scissors is the sharpest scissors, you know? So like, it has to be something else." That is where storytelling, that is where connecting to your consumer, understanding your consumer, building a brand that people want to be a part of, like, that's where all that comes into play. And that is, and to me, Robert, I have internalize that in this way. I feel like every entrepreneur should walk around with a really healthy anxiety. I have this for myself, just a really healthy anxiety that nobody is paying attention and that people will be overlooking you constantly, and that you need to be always making your case for relevancy, not waving your hands and just trying to grab people's attention, but like making your case for relevancy.
There's a, you know, Giorgio Armani just passed away.
Yeah.
And I was a huge fan, not necessarily of the clothes, which were beautiful. And I first came across him when he did that movie, American Gigolo, with Richard Gere. And it was just this iconic. And I was a young kid, and it was very aspirational to me, not to be a gigolo, obviously, but just the clothes and the lifestyle and the beauty of it. You know, I was this geeky kid in high school, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
But there was an interview he did years ago, and he said, "I live in a constant state of anxiety and frustration because I see the world for what I could make it and what it could be and not for what it is." And I think it goes to what you just said, is you have to have a certain level of anxiety, urgency, frustration, because if you wake up every day and everything is great, then... what are you going to change?
Right. What's the incentive to do anything?
Right.
Hey, Robert, when you first started with Shark Tank, did you have an idea of how the things that you had learned in building in cybersecurity could transfer to these completely random wide range of industries? Like the way in which you talk now is so fluent in business philosophy that could apply to everybody. But I'm curious if that was a transition for you coming in from one space and then basically being asked to invest in like silly sweaters, which had to be so strange at first.
So the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started, so Kevin and I started the same day. And the show started in Canada and became a massive hit there. And then we brought it to the States. And I did the show for 1 year. And you have to keep in mind, I'm an enterprise sales guy.
Right.
That's my entire background since I'm 20 years old. I mean, we sell to multi-billion dollar companies. It's very serious cybersecurity stuff. I'm very, very technical. I do the show for a year. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? Like these people are pitching socks. What do I know about socks?
Yeah.
So I actually quit the show after the first year.
No, the Canadian version or the
Canadian version.
Like, oh my gosh.
22 years ago.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I don't know anything about these industries. And so Kevin takes me out for dinner and he says to me, there are two things I'm going to say to you, but let me start with saying you're an idiot. The first thing he says is, this show is going to be huge. And I have to give him the credit, all the credit in the world, because nobody, including the producers at the time, thought that was going to be the case. Hmm. The genius of Kevin was he realized we are not tapping into a business show. We are tapping into people's dreams and aspirations. The second thing he said to me is, you have to let go of the subject matter. You have to focus on the execution of the dream. And I thought about that, and I realized in starting a business, there is certain execution steps that you do. You have to have an idea. You have to sell. You have to market. You have to raise money. Like, none of those things are related necessarily to the subject matter.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the way, you have to be great at your craft. But so much of what we do applies to so many businesses. And then I became good at that. But the guy who really changed it around for me was Mark Burnett. When we did the US show, we weren't seeing many hardcore cybersecurity enterprise pitches.
Yes, I'm not sure I've seen one of them. Yeah.
So I take Mark Burnett out for dinner and I said, Mark, I'm a serious business guy. Why aren't we seeing serious businesses? And Mark looks at me and says, Robert, you seem like a very nice guy, but what you do is really boring to the average American consumer. You're missing the point of the show. Shark Tank is a platform. We're an accelerant for great ideas and great businesses to reach a wider audience. So forget the cybersecurity stuff and focus on how you got there.
Mm.
And I really believe in that. I really think that in order to start a great business, the entrepreneur first has to work on themselves. You know, show me a small business that's in trouble, I'll show you an entrepreneur that's in trouble. Show me a great small business, and I'll show you an entrepreneur that has their shit together,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think all those things apply to any business.
Let's take that insight and just flip the perspective a little bit. Because, okay, so you're this very serious business person, knows enterprise sales, and now you're sitting down and you're listening to these pitches from all sorts of crazy, usually consumer-facing industries, very small businesses. And at first you're thinking, this is not for me, and then you come to understand it. The flip side mismatch of that is that, and I feel like this is something that people don't really appreciate if they're coming from outside of business, which is that most of the people who are on Shark Tank outside of a television situation have absolutely no business pitching their businesses to the kinds of investors that you guys are, right? I mean, it's just not what happens in the real world. You don't generally make like a potato that you send in the mail and then bring it in front of these kinds of businesses. You just don't. So that, I think, number one, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on like the story that people should understand about like what businesses actually require investment, because Shark Tank is it's an amazing show, and it is a story about real dreams, but it is also a story about what it takes to build a company. And I worry that the world of entrepreneurs sometimes thinks they need investors when they don't.
Wow. Jason, such a great point.
Mm.
A little bit of Shark Tank behind the scenes.
Yeah.
In our second or third seasons, we had these great businesses come on, and Mark and I would look at them and we would say, hey man, you're on the right path. You don't need a shark.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody would invest. And so two or three pitches go by and the producers are like, okay, time out. They sit us down and they say, okay, sharks, you're missing the point of the show. People are coming to get an investment. And that's what I always remind people is we are a TV show.
Right.
The premise is you come on asking for money and we invest. The only downside of Shark Tank, the only downside is I sometimes worry, to your point, that's what we tell people.
Right.
Is you can't start a business without an investor. And it's so not true. If you have a great business, very few businesses need funding. Businesses don't fail because of lack of funding. Businesses typically fail because of lack of market acceptance. And so the idea of Shark Tank is every business needs an investor. And it's simply not true. Well, I think what we're trying to teach people is in order to get an investor, you have to be at a certain size, you have to have certain characteristics, and you're going to get asked these questions. So even if you're making a potato peeler toy or you're making a serious business, the investors are typically going to ask you the same set of questions. And that is the genius of Shark Tank. How many people in America get to be in the room when people like us are asking those questions? And I think before Shark Tank, nobody ever had access to that. What person starting a sock company would see how five sophisticated investors would value a product or value a business and what questions they would ask? So even though not all businesses may need the investment, there's a discipline in being able to answer the questions that investors are going to ask you.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? Because the next thing that I was going to ask was what your guidance is for those entrepreneurs as they first seek that investment. The ones that, first of all, have done some kind of assessment, which maybe you have some guidance on, about whether or not they are even a business that is ready for or appropriately should seek an investor. But what should they be ready to talk about? And how should they be communicating, to your point, businesses don't fail for lack of funding, they fail for lack of market acceptance, being able to communicate that market acceptance?
Great question. I had a great piece of advice, and I forget who said this to me. And, you know, my first business, the only word that can describe it is chaos. I had no idea what I was doing. I remember I thought about getting a loan from the bank. And the bank manager said to me, come back tomorrow with a spreadsheet of your cash flow. And I was like, absolutely. And then went home and found out what a spreadsheet was. I'd never used Excel. And I stayed up till like 3 a.m. creating a spreadsheet and then shut the computer down. And at the time, there was no autosave feature. And so I lost it all. So the advice I got was, you should never start a business thinking you're going to sell it. But you should always start a business with the discipline of selling it. And so if you think about that, the buyer that's buying your business or the investor, because when you get an investment, what you're really doing is selling a piece of your business. The most common mistake I see in entrepreneurs is they think the investor is their friend. They think when they get an investment, it's like, we're partnering. We're in this thing together. And to a certain degree, that's true. But what you're also doing is selling a piece of your business. And so that buyer, what information do they want to see? And so my next business, I started day one with income statements on a monthly basis. I started with balance sheets. I had a rigor of reporting for my small business that none of my competitors had. So I had cash flow statements, I had income statement, I had balance sheet. People trust and respect you, but they really respect the data. And the data, if it supports you, makes the investment easier. The worst thing is when you see an entrepreneur come into a room and they're great and they tell a great story and it's fantastic. And then you say, oh my gosh, can you send me the data on your business? and then they send you chaos.
Mm.
So financial information and the way that you package it has to support the story that you're going to say. Then the second part is market growth. One of the biggest mistakes we see is people have projections for 5 to 10 years, and they're always rosy. As Kevin says, I've never seen a bad sales forecast.
Right.
Sure, I care what you're going to do in 5 to 10 years. I really care what you're going to do in the next 12 months. And Cuban is great at that. People come in and say, oh my gosh, our sales were great for the last few years. And Mark will look at him and say, tell me your sales last month. And then tell me your sales the month before. So people focus too much on the long term and not enough on the short term. And in business, as you know, is you have to survive every step in order to get to participate in the next step.
What you just said there reminded me of a conversation that I had a while ago with Mike Maples Jr., who is pioneered in a way like hyper early stage investing. And he said to me that to him, investing is simply a matter of risk assessment, and that it would be helpful for entrepreneurs to understand that whenever they are talking to an investor, that investor is basically making a risk assessment. And that's true whether or not it's a seasoned venture capitalist or it's like your mom and you're doing a family and friends round. Because either way, what they're thinking is essentially, what are the chances that I'll lose my money? What are the chances that this will make money? And what amount of potential return is worth whatever risk I'm being asked to take? And so what you're describing, and I say this to you because I wonder if you have consciously think this way, or maybe even just framing it like that brings up a thought, but like what you're describing in the numbers and the reason why that matters is because ultimately great numbers and a entrepreneur who has their numbers together and the ability to communicate that is really just someone who is minimizing the risk.
So well said. Yeah. Why is America the bastion in the free world of entrepreneurism? Why has no other country ever been able to repeat that? And I'm generalizing because obviously there's great entrepreneurs in Canada, Australia, everywhere.
Around the world, yeah.
But America is the gold standard. And I've often thought about this because I'm Canadian. I brought my business to America. Then we bought a big company in London. Then we bought, you know, we had a big presence in India. I live in Australia part of the time. I've done Shark Tank Canada, Australia, America, and even Egypt. And there are certain characteristics that are common across the world. But there's something distinctly unique about American psyche. And is exactly what you said. It is the appetite for risk. American appetite for risk is like no other place in the world. People will make an assessment, and even in the face of great odds for potentially greater returns, they'll go down that road. And I don't know whether it's the Wild West or just the way that America was created, but I think that's what makes it so unique in starting a business. But I think it's not just investors, it's also entrepreneurs. Like when you start a business, you are making a conscious decision to leave your job. You're making a conscious decision to raise money. You're putting yourself on the line. It's risk management in every way.
I have a hypothesis for where that tolerance for risks comes from, which I'll share with you because I'd be curious for your feedback. But then also, I would love to hear you talk about how you calculate risk in your own head as you're hearing from entrepreneurs, because I think that that's a valuable thing for entrepreneurs to hear as they approach their own investors. So, but first, the hypothesis, which comes from a conversation that I had a long time ago with a pair of American investors who decided to open up a fund that focused specifically on Africa. And they told me that the greatest challenge that they've had in investing in African founders is that African founders are very hesitant to talk about failure. And the reason they hypothesize is just because there aren't enough years worth of stories of African founders who risked it all and were eating ramen in a garage and then built Apple. Like, America is full of those stories. And Africa, because it's just, the economy is just developing in a way that America's developed a couple decades ago. Like, it just doesn't, it hasn't accrued that many stories yet. It will, but it hasn't yet. And so that means, as a result, that when an entrepreneur says to their parents and to their friends, you know what, I'm not going to take this job at a law firm, I'm going to start my own business. In America, somebody says that and the parents and the friends start to cycle in their head through all of these stories that they know of people who did a version of that, or the famous people, the Steve Jobs and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the whoever who took some large risk and it paid off. And they say, ah, I understand the framework for the thing that you're doing, and that makes sense to me. But in Africa, you know, and not just Africa, but also developing nations around the world, like, they just don't have that story as clearly in the culture. And so that inhibits people. And it also means that when something goes really wrong in a business, they're afraid to talk about it because it validates all the people around them who said, that's not a good idea. And so these investors were really having trouble because they want to hear the failures. They want to hear an entrepreneur who can say, this went wrong and here's how we addressed it. And this is the reality of the business right now. And if you're not getting that, then you don't really know what you're investing in. And that made me think about how valuable it is that we are telling those stories. And Shark Tank is certainly a part of that. People come on, they tell you the sob story, they cry, and they talk about how this thing failed for years, and then they did whatever they did to bring it back. And I think that opens up a tolerance for risk.
The Big Tasty is back at McDonald's, but now it's a double. It's the beefiest Big Tasty of all time ever. Oh, got a bit intense there. The new Double Big Tasty, now at McDonald's. Available until the 4th of Jan, 2026, from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Greed. I think there's a maniacal acceptance for the obsession of making it. Sure, failure is part of it, but I want to hear more about the maniacal. You're working 24 hours a day, not eating, sleeping in the office kind of story. Mm. I'm comfortable with failure. And I think most people that start a business, whether they admit it or not, you have to have that. When I started my first business at 22 or 23, and I'm an Eastern European immigrant, mm-hmm. I came home and I told my mom I'm starting a business. And my mom looked at me with shock in her eyes and shook her head and said, don't worry, you'll get a job one day. So in my culture, starting a business wasn't aspiration.
Right.
The people that started businesses were the ones that couldn't get a job.
Right. Totally. So right. Plays a totally different role in the culture. Yeah, that's really interesting.
But to your point, how do we assess risk? So I have a three-step process of assessing risk. And again, there's shades of gray, right? Sure. You have to be comfortable in the gray. But in general, and we talk about this on Shark Tank, Jason, all the time, you know, because in between pitches, and if you ask all the sharks, we would agree with all three of these. So step number one is you. Before you sell me on your company or your product, you got to sell me on you. Mm. Like, people come out and they think my company and product and whatever is so great. The story doesn't matter. I don't matter. And people think that we're asking about you because we're making a TV show and we're trying to get the email. There's an element of that, but I want to know, what makes you? Have you failed before? Have you started before? Because inevitably, every business is going to hit hard times. And I want to invest in somebody that I believe is going to be able to navigate those rough seas. Mm-hmm. So that's step one. Before you sell me on the business, sell me on you. The second step, though, is does the data support you? So people always think we want the data in order to find or uncover something fantastic. The number one thing the data tells me is the story of you consistent with the data that you sent me. You just told me how you're great at sales. You told me how you're maniacal product development. Then you send me the income statement and your sales are like this. It doesn't match to what you just told me.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather have slow predictive growth than these wide arcs. And did the data show me something that you were trying to hide or didn't tell me about? And then the third point is, what's the value proposition that I can affect? So meaning, why isn't your company bigger? Is there something that I can add to? Maybe it's product development, maybe it's cash, maybe it's distribution, maybe it's a different market. Because if you're doing everything perfectly and the numbers match, how am I going to make it better? And so there, you know, I want a business. We all want a business where there's a bit of a missing piece that we can affect.
Do you think that last part differs by investor? And that's maybe a Shark Tank question or just a kind of general investor question.
The most common question we get a lot of times is, do you wish you would have invested in ScrubDaddy? Do you wish you would invest, you know, and then people ask Damon, do you wish you would have invested in TipCLs? And Damon had a great answer to this. And he says, sure, hindsight is perfect, but a great deal is the right shark matched with the right investment. And so, yes, every investor is different and every shark is different. And sometimes it's the combination of those things that make the magic.
Right, which means you really have to understand who you're pitching to. You know, not any different, actually, interestingly, I hadn't thought about this, but not any different than the Reebok president's scissors thing, right? Which is to say that it's not just about the product and how good it is, it's how the product connects to the consumer. It's not how good the company and the founder is, it's how it connects to the investor and what that investor can offer. Did you?
Well, you remember Jason Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street
guy. Jordan, yeah.
Yeah, Jordan, sorry. And, you know, whenever he does speeches, people always ask him, sell me the pen, you know, the famous line from Wolf of Wall Street. So I was doing a big event and somebody asked me that question. And I said, I can sell this pen to anybody with one caveat. And I said, what's the caveat? I said, I get to ask a question first. And so they said, sell me the pen. And I said, tell me who I'm selling it to. Because the key for market demand is exactly what you just said, is what is your target client? Why do they need your product?
Yeah.
People focus too much on the product and the business before they understand why people need it.
I'm thinking back to earlier parts of our conversation. You're telling these stories about being unsure whether or not Shark Tank made sense for you. And I wonder if there's an evolution that you went through to find what your relevancy was to the companies that you invest in. Or like we've kind of talked about it the other way around. The entrepreneur needs to understand what they need that investor for. And they need to be able to communicate that. It's not the investor's job to figure it out. It's the entrepreneur's job to articulate it. But you must have gone through some kind of journey to figure out, well, what does Robert Herjavec have to offer a company like Tipsy Elves? Like, did you have an answer to that originally? Did you have to figure that out?
I had to figure that out. That's so well said. What I had to figure out was that in my own personal journey, the plateaus and the conflict and those hardships most people are going to face. And so my value add to a lot of the businesses was perspective. When you hit that wall, what are the options? And I think anybody who has built great businesses has had to think outside of the box. you know, there are many ways to skin the cat. And I think that's the value of having somebody who's been there. And it's not an age thing. It's not a wisdom thing. It's probably just a battle scar thing. When you're in the forum fighting the good fight to survive, you're going to learn certain things. And when an entrepreneur hits those things, I think all the sharks have this incredible ability to say, look, have you thought of this? What about that? And most businesses need advice more than they need money.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? Because I think that would surprise a lot of people.
I think if I had the 60-year-old Robert telling the 22-year-old Robert what to do, that would have been much more valuable than if somebody would have given me $5 million when I started my first business. Because when you hit those crossroads, you hire your first employee. What do you look for? You get your first investor. You get your first customer. How do you get recurring revenue? Like, business is so complex. There's so many issues. Just finding clarity in the eye of chaos is just so hard.
Yeah, you know, when you just said that about the $5 million versus the advice, there's probably an interesting calculation that can be done. How much more valuable on a dollar figure amount is the advice than the $5 million? So like, the advice is saving a lot of money because it's avoiding mistakes, and it is also accelerating growth by avoiding mistakes. And that, if you do it right, is worth more than the $5 million. Or you would just waste the $5 million making those mistakes.
If capital and education was the only currency for success, every MBA working at an equity firm would be Steve Jobs. And it's not, as you well know. And so that is the currency of obsession, hard work, drive, ambition. It's so complicated because you cannot unpack the entrepreneur from the business when you start. Every great business, and that's why I love those stories, you know, when my kids and I, and that's what I'm trying to teach my kids, you know, we'll drive down the street and we'll see an ice cream shop. And I'll say to them, you know, somebody owned that business. Why do you think they started it? And my kids are like, oh, I don't know. Maybe they loved ice cream. And I'm like, maybe, let's look it up. So we'll look at these brands and we'll find out, oh my gosh, this business was started 20 years ago by this guy who got fired. Like, I love those stories. And I think when you find a great business, there's typically a great story or an interesting story at the beginning of that.
I think people who are outside of business tend to think of it as a exercise in tactics and money, but from inside, you realize that it is as human a pursuit as anything else.
Like, well said.
So my background is, I don't know anything about business. I was bouncing around different magazines. I worked at Men's Health. I was like Boston Magazine. It's like random stuff. And when I got to Entrepreneur, honestly, I was so similar to you, I guess, in feeling out of place at Shark Tank in a way. I was really afraid, Robert, to stand in front of a bunch of entrepreneurs and say anything to them because, you know, what did I know? I hadn't built a business. And the breakthrough for me was that I realized that so much of this is just about being human and understanding the logic of being a human. Like, so much of what we've even been talking about here in an interesting way, I don't know, tell me if you think I'm right or wrong here, but like, so much of what we've been talking about, even in how to understand investors and so on, is it's really just about understanding other people and what people think and what value they see in themselves and what value they see in you. And it's like, it's just another version of that in another space. And once I understood that, that was 10 years ago. Now I've learned a number of things about business and have been involved in building some, but once I understood that, I felt, okay, I know how to make my way in this world.
Again, so well said. there are two parts to starting a business. Mm-hmm. There's the mechanics, which most people who've never done it think about. The spreadsheets, the market acceptance, the distributions, product strategy, cost of goods. Those are the mechanics of a business. But remember that lady at your event, which was great, asked me the question about your business. And the first thing I said is, how long have you been in business? She said, I just started. And I said to her, I said, congratulations. Because every time you see a small business, somebody made a courageous decision. And she was so happy and felt so good about that.
Yeah.
But look how quickly those questions transitioned from the mechanics to the human. Mm-hmm. And we started talking about courage. What did you talk about? Acceptance of failure, risk. Those are human characteristics. And that's what makes business so hard is you have to have the human element of every great business. But somewhere along the way, you have to learn the mechanics. Mm-hmm. You can learn the mechanics. The human part of it is really hard. Show me a great business, and I'll show you somebody with great purpose. Show me a business. Why does somebody work 24 hours a day, sleep in their garage or the office, go through hell in the face of insurmountable odds without some great purpose? And people think it's a mechanics thing, paycheck, a little more cash, and it's not. You know, like it is impossible to put yourself out there and go through the hell that is starting a business in order to make a little more money, especially when you do make a little more money. You can tell me that people start a business in order to make a little more cash, and I'll accept that. But to continue after you've made the first 100,000, 500,000, million, to continue with that level of obsession, scratch below the surface, there's a greater story.
Can you take that answer and then map it onto your own growth? And here's why I ask you, because I have to say, Robert, it was extremely interesting talking to you on stage. You know, we had met 5 minutes before, and then we got on stage, and all I really knew of you, aside from doing some research and seeing you on Shark Tank for many, many years. And Shark Tank actually gives you a very small window into somebody. As I've met you and other sharks, it's been really interesting to see like what parts of you show up on the screen, but then what parts are not there. You are on the show a very human character, but in real life, you like blend, and you've even done it in this conversation, you blend business tactics with human insight, and you're really fluid in moving back and forth with that, which not everybody is. And I wonder, as you think back on your own development as a entrepreneur and an investor, did you feel like you got into business as a person who understood people, or as a person who understood business? And then which one did you have to catch up on?
Gosh, that is such a lucid observation. I was just talking to somebody about that yesterday, and they wanted to start a business, and they were telling me all the things that they're not good at. And the advice they'd gotten was, you have to work on the things you're not good at in order to start. And my advice was the complete opposite. I said, when you go and compete, the world is so competitive that you have to take the things you're good at and become great at them. Because if you focus on the things you're not good at, someone's going to eat your lunch.
Yeah.
And I started in business with the standard ideology is, oh, I'm not good at, you know, I'm not good at financials. I'm not good at cost of goods and manufacturing. I better really focus on that. And I'd go to customers and try to talk about those things, and I just couldn't compete. There were people that were better at that than I was. What I realized early on is I was pretty good at reading people on the human side. So I over-indexed to the human element of it. So when we used to go on sales calls, a lot of our competitors will go into the features, why our product's better. I, because I wasn't good at the technology initially, I over-indexed into what the product would do for them. So my competitors will walk in and say, here's why I have the best product under the sun. Here's the five things my product does. I'd walk in and say, we have a great product. But before I tell you about my great product, can you tell me the problems you're trying to solve? And people will be like, oh, well, you know, we need something that does this and this. And so I over-indexed on the human side because that's the only thing I was good at because I didn't have the technology. The Bible says, teach ye with parables. I haven't met a great entrepreneur who can't take their subject matter and relate it to me on a human level. Like, I'm pretty sure if Elon Musk was sitting here and we said to him, tell me what Starlink does, that he would tell you the value of Starlink as opposed to how the satellites work and all of that kind of stuff. Now, he knows everything about satellites and all the other stuff, just like I know everything about cyber. But I think at the beginning, it's about the value add of your business.
I love that advice. Do you think in the entrepreneurs that you meet and work with, that people have a clear understanding of what they are best at?
No, that's why business is so hard. The first thing you have to fix in any business is yourself. And what makes it hard is in order to survive risk and the hardships of business, we tend to lie to ourselves for no other reason than survival. The biggest lies you tell in life are the ones you tell yourself. And so my experience is great entrepreneurs, while they may portray a certain image or facade to the world, when they look in the mirror, they're very honest with themselves, what they're good at, what they're not good at, and all those things.
Let me just ask you maybe a final thing building off of that, which is, well, actually, first of all, let me just validate the thing that you said, because I feel it myself. The way in which I got comfortable in this ecosystem that I didn't know anything about was to realize that I think I have one skill, frankly. And that skill is that I just know how to either take things that people tell me and then either repeat it back to them in ways that get them to think, or repeat it to other people in a way that is helpful to them. Like, I'm just processing information and repeating it back to people. It's basically my skill, but I found it to be a really useful one and a really liberating one. And I will tell you the thing that I am trying to figure out for myself as a, not in this particular moment, just as like a lifelong question. So I'll just kind of ask you, this as maybe like a follow-up to the thing that you said. And as a final question is, so your advice was, you have to figure out the thing that you're best at, and then you maximize that. And you also, you also can discover that that thing is a strength. I think that a lot of people, Robert, also are left with this question of, I think I do something really well, and I just can't figure out how to turn that into something. Like, I know how to solve a problem. I know that I'm useful, but I just don't know how to make something great out of that. Or I do, but I don't know how to do it better. And I'm really taken by the way that you were just talking a minute ago. You understood people better than the technology at first. So you walked in there and you said, I'm just going to understand people. But you also committed yourself to building this technology and somehow understood that this fusion of human understanding and this very non-human thing, which is cybersecurity, could somehow come together. And I don't know. I'm asking you a big of a soup of a final question here, but I just wonder what it raises for you as you think about
it.
Yeah.
It's such a great point. And it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, which is your level of comfort about living in the gray. So human element, what am I good at? What's my skill set? Once you figure that out, how do you then convert that to a valuable product, service, something? And so conversion of your skill set is really hard. And people assume that if you become really good at something, it's just automatically going to convert to a business. I had a friend of mine that started a business, and she was phenomenal at her craft. Phenomenal. Her business began to grow, and she didn't love running a business. So her love was in the doing, but she didn't want to do all the other stuff. She didn't want to run the business. She didn't want to hire people. She didn't want to operate. So she tried to outsource all of that right from day one. And you have to have a love for running a business. You have to have a love for your craft. So for me, the first thing you have to love is yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to love yourself and believe you add value to this world. Not many great entrepreneurs or businesses are started by mopey people.
Yeah.
But once you love that, you have to love the process. You have to love going to work. You have to love building. You have to love all that stuff. Doesn't mean you have to always do it, but you have to love it. Mm-hmm. And then the third part of it is you have to love the scale of it. It's continuous.
Yeah.
And it is that insatiable desire to be better without being greedy.
Mm.
And it's the Japanese word. I forget the word. Is it Kaizen? Which
is, that's right. Yeah.
Every day I want to be 1% better.
Mm.
So I started my first business because I needed to pay my mortgage. But very quickly I became relatively financially successful. You know, I'm making $50,000, $100,000 a year. But what kept me going was continuous improvement.
Yeah.
And I think all of those things translate back to who you are as an individual.
Robert, such a delight talking to you. Thank you for your time in person. And now you were full of wisdom, and it's just a real delight to dig in.
I'm full of wisdom because I'm old, Jason.
I guess that's the one benefit of it, isn't it? And that's our episode. Now let's keep the conversation going. I write a newsletter called One Thing Better, where each week I offer one new way to be successful and satisfied and build a career or company you love. You can find it at onethingbetter.email. That's a web address. Just plug it into a browser. onethingbetter.email. And if you get one of those emails and reply, it goes straight to my inbox and I will get back to you. Problem Solvers comes out every Monday morning, so make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. The show is produced by Emily Holmes and Money News Network. My name is Jason Pfeiffer. See you next week.